For the past few weeks, we've been doing a series on marriage, and the reason why I've been doing this series is because I believe that it is the key that when you're married, that is the key to your ultimate reaching of your, or in helping you to enable to reach your full potential when you're married. Also believe that when you're married, it helps your partner, your husband or your wife, to reach your full potential, or it absolutely prevents them from reaching their full potential. And so in thinking about this series, I thought about, you know, kind of there's some things that I want you to do. I want you to be your full potential. And in order to that, you got to live out the relationship that Jesus demonstrated for the church. He called the church his bride. And in doing that, he demonstrated stuff to us. And so that this series is about, it's about living out what Jesus demonstrated in our lives. And so I have a few goals for this. And the series is called I Promise. And goal number one is to teach you how to love like Jesus. Because that's the ultimate way in which to love, this unselfish, is giving love, which is to love like Jesus. And our marriage would be so much better and we'd be so much happier if we learn how to love like Jesus. Number two is to how to be lovable, how to be loved. And number three, which is people can normally get through number one and two, but they have a big problem with this. It's kind of to stay in love. And that's the reason why our divorce rate is really what it is. It's because people struggle with that number three, how to stay in love. And what I'm about to tell you, Donna will corroborate, right? She's up front here, and she's going to keep me on the straight and narrow, because that's what she does when she's up front. Yeah, especially in this series. But outside of my boy's spiritual condition, there is nothing that occupies my mind share more than the woman that will come into their lives. I'm telling you from the start, every single woman that they know, I go through this series, and y'all don't know this, but I go through this checklist in my life, and I think about them. I'm like, would that person make a good spouse for my boys? So all y'all know, you're all on notice, because that's what I do. Yeah. My boys don't know this, but I do. My wife knows this. And the reason is for the reason that I said before, because the secret, if God chooses for them to get married, to them living out their full potential, is to have a helpmeet, to have a, and there's a word I gave you a couple weeks ago, but that person undergirding them, and them undergirding that person. And so I think about that, and from the day they were born, actually from the day that we discovered that Donna was pregnant, we've been praying for, before we even knew the sex, we've been praying for their spouses. And we pray all the time. It's one of the standard pieces of our prayers, and that we pray about them is because we want that. And what I want for them is exactly what I want for you. And I want for you who are married or who want to get married, who plan to get married, is that your marriage will be all that is meant to be, and a bag of chips to add and a soda on the side. And I believe that's possible if we simply do the things that God outlined for us to do. So we started out the series talking about two things. Well, the first one was the principle of priority, right? And we talked about the principle of priority, and we said that most people go out and chase after their number one. I want the number one in my life. But the reality is that you should chase after your number one and chase, secondly, after your number two. So your partner is not your number one. Your partner is your number two. And when you put your number one in the rightful place, your number two will feel like their number one. And that's just the way it is. And so the thing about that is that you got to put your number two above your number three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. And God teaches you how to do that. And then the second week, we talked about the principle of pursuit. The principle of pursuit. And I loved last week's message because it illustrated the truth, or 2 weeks ago, that it's so simple, but yet still it's so profound. I'm going to drop it on you again in case you forgot it. See, so many times people start out and they're googly-eyed in love, and nobody Well, I guess some people do, but generally speaking, people don't get married unless they're in love. And they think this is the one. They complete. They do all this stuff, and they do, and they're in love. And then you fast forward a few years in, and you're like, I wonder what happened. And they're like, I don't love them anymore. They don't love me. They're not. The reality is that if you did the things that you once did to make them fall in love with you, if you did the things that you once did, you'll get what you once got. The things that you did to make them fall in love. And so people's like, well, I don't love anymore. I'm like, how are you doing? Remember, take it back to when you were dating. Did you? Are you doing those things again? Well, nah, well, because just do it. And if you do, and people's like, well, you know, that person really is nicer. They look like they're soulmate. And the grass always looks greener wherever you water it. The grass doesn't look greener on the other side. The grass looks greener on the other side because somebody is watering that grass on the other side, or you're watering that grass on the other side. But the grass is always greener wherever you water it. So the principle of pursuit says, water your own grass. Don't smoke it. Yeah. That was free. So today I want to talk about the third principle. The principle is called the principle of partnership. And it's really this entire message series. I really realize that I just keep finding more messages that I can do on these two verses. It's found in Genesis 22, 24, and 25. And the message goes like this. It says, the verse, and it's also found, it's quoted again in the New Testament. But it says, you know, and just to set this up a little bit in case you're not aware of it, is that God had just finished making the world and, you know, forming it and putting the animals and stuff. And he looked around and he said, you know, all these animals are good and the world's good, but I need somebody for Adam because he couldn't find a helper suitable. So he said, I'm going to make me a woman. And, you know, the old preacher joke, you know, when he saw her, he said, whoa, man. And he's like, woman. And that's how she got her name. But then he went on to say, this explains why a man leaves his father and his mother and is joined to his wife, and the two are united into one. In the King James Version, it says the two shall become one flesh. And the obvious thing that people think about here, at least I know guys do, is think about sex. I'm like, well, that's the reason, you know, the two is going to become one flesh. But if you like think about it like that, you like miss the whole point. You miss the whole thing, because that obviously is one part of it, but it goes much deeper than that. And in order for you to get what that means, you have to understand one word. And today, all we're going to talk about is one word, which is really what that means. That word is covenants. The covenant, two should be united in one flesh, and they'd be united into one, and it forms a covenant. And God illustrates this covenant. I'm going to kind of take it on a passage of scripture and talk a little bit more about covenants. I'm going to read you through the story. It's found in Genesis 15, and to just kind of set the story up here is that it's a story of Abraham, and God had called this man. This man didn't know God, but somehow he felt an inkling, and people want to know, well, how do you know if you heard from God? And we have a series on that. You can find it online. But Abraham believed that there was something inside of him. Some either he saw something, somebody told him, but something awakened inside of him where he said that he needed to leave the land where he was going. And he's like, where am I going? Pretty much what all his friends and family would have asked him, where are you going? He's like, I'm going to the land where I got in my head. It kind of sounds kind of crazy, but he did that. And so he's there, and you know, a couple things happen. And so God is not ready to give him next instructions. And so here's what it says. Sometime after that, he left there. The Lord spoke to Abraham in a vision and said, do not be afraid, Abraham. And you like this, like 9 times out of 10 when God speaks to you, he starts out with, do not be afraid, because you're like, whoa, it's like, whoa. Anyway, do not be afraid, Abraham. And he gives him, I believe it's 5 promises. He gives him 5 promises. Promise number 1, I will protect you. Promise number 2, you'll be rich. Your reward will be great. He then goes on to say, but Abraham replied, he's like, oh God, I appreciate all of that I'm going to be great. You know, I appreciate all that. But what good is all of that when I don't even have a son? Since you've given me no children, like, you know, like God didn't understand the son thing. He's like, you didn't give me any children, God. Eliezer of Damascus, who's my servant, will inherit my promise number 2. And God says, and then he goes on to says the third time, like God didn't hear before. He's like, and in case you forgot, God, you didn't give me any descendants of my own. So one of my servants will be my heir. Then the Lord said to him, not wrong. No, your servant will not be your heir. You will have a promise number three. You will have a son of your own who will be your heir. Then the Lord took Abram outside and said to him, promise number four, look in the skies and count the stars. That's if you can. That's how many descendants you're going to have. It's number four. Abram believed. He highlighted the word believe, and the Lord counted him as righteous because of his faith. Abram believed God, but, and then this is not even the message today, but I'm just going to just point out, he believed God, but he still did something. After he believed God, the Lord says, I am the Lord who brought you out of the Ur, the place you live, to give you promise number five, this land, as your possession. Remember, it just said Abraham believed. He lied, oh God, oh sovereign Lord, I believe, but how can I be sure? It's kind of interesting, right? Because he believed and he counted on to the righteousness, but yet he's asking God, how can I be sure that I'll actually possess it? And the Lord told Abraham, he says, bring me a three-year-old heifer or female cow and a three-year-old female goat and a three-year-old ram and a turtle dove and a young pigeon. Abraham's like, all right, I'll get that. And so Abraham presented all these to God and killed them. And these were kind of instructions. He doesn't tell you, but by implications you can get it. And he took every one of them, he took the cow and he cut it. And he put one side of the cow here, one half here, and one half here with a stream of blood in the middle. And he cut whatever that other animal was, right? He cut the female goat. Put it here and the other one here. And he cut the ram and he cut one here and he cut one here. And so in the middle you have this blood separating this. And the sun was going down and he cut it and he's like, okay, what's up? The sun was going down and Abraham fell and he fell asleep. Fell into a deep sleep. And you know, it was such a deep sleep that he was like, there was no dreaming going on. He was out until he had a dream. The sun went down, a darkness fell, and Abraham saw in the midst of his darkness of his dream a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch walk right between the halves of the carcasses, right through the blood. And so the Lord made a covenant with Abraham that day and says, I have given you this land, given you this land to your descendants. These are all the five promises, all in one. All the way from the border of Egypt to the great Euphrates River. As I read through this thing, I could probably do 10 sermons out of here, but I want to point out one thing, that God made a covenant with Abraham, and that covenant did not, in all the way when he made that covenant with Abraham, there was one thing that God didn't do. God didn't say, Abraham, this covenant is with you only if you do this, 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 this. He said, I'm making this covenant with you. And the first thing is that covenant are unilateral. It means that it doesn't depend on what the other person does. The covenant is the covenant. The covenant is, I am making a covenant with you. The second thing is, a covenant requires action. In order for the covenant to take effect, something had to happen. It wasn't just talk. It required some action. It required a demonstration, a covenant. And God not only promised that, but he followed through by walking through the blood. And walking through the blood, he sealed the covenant. And you know, when many people think about marriage, they think about, you know, people's like, they may be living together, and they're like, living together is like, Well, we're committed to each other and da 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 da. I'm like, well, why don't you get the, no, this is marriage is just a piece of paper. I'm like, why don't you get the piece of paper then? Well, I'll get to it. See, it's more than just living together. So people are like, well, I got the piece of paper. And they think of the piece of paper as a contract. And that's really how our state, how our government thinks about marriage. And that's why when we had this whole issue, what I'm about to say is a little bit controversial, about same-sex marriages a couple years ago and what the Supreme Court, I'm like, well, in the eyes of the state, it's a contract. It's a contract that gives you employee benefits. It gives you right of survivorships. It gives you access to the bank account when somebody's sick. It gives you the right to make healthcare decision. It's a contract. And so the state governs a contract. But God has not called us for a contract. He's called us for a covenant. And the difference between a contract and a covenant is that a contract is bilateral. A contract is that I will do this if you do this. I will do that if you do that. And if you don't do that, then I won't do this. A covenant is unilateral. A covenant says I'll only do this. That's it. Now, there are things that happen, there are consequences that happen when you don't reciprocate, but a covenant still stands. I'm making a covenant with you. It's a covenant that still stands. And a contract is based on mutual distrust. A contract, that's why you have all these pieces inside there, that all the fine print that the lawyers in our midst love to read through. And they put words in there that we don't understand, like thereunto, hitherunto, appertaining. That God knows what that means, except them. But it's based on mutual distrust. It has all these what ifs in there. What ifs, what if, what if, what if, what if, what if. And this is what's going to happen, what if. And we all know what happens. Because what if you don't keep it? I get half. And I get joint custody of the kids every two weekends and every Tuesday and Wednesday nights. But whereas a contract is based on mutual distrust, a covenant is based on mutual trust. It's based on mutual commitment. And the original Hebrew language has a word here. It's just in doing these word studies, just going through this. It's a word called bereth. So it's pronounced like beer, wrath, bereth. And the literal word means a covenant is a cutting and a joining. It's a cutting and a joining. It's cutting off something else and joining to something else. It's saying, I'm cutting off from this and I'm joining to this, and to form a binding agreement. Not between me and another person, but me to another person. And the ancient, in Jewish Hebrew weddings, they understood what God had established there. And so I was reading in one of the Jewish writings, is literally reading through what would happen in an ancient Jewish wedding ceremony. It's actually kind of really interesting to me. What would happen in their ancient Jewish ceremonies is that I always do this, right? I have all these plans and all these props, and then I leave it at home. But they would take a knife at the wedding ceremony, and they would hold up the groom's hand, and they would make an incision. They would literally cut it till the hand's bleeding. And then they'd get the bride, and they would hold up her hand, and they would cut it. The priest would do that. Not a deep cut, but a cut till it draws blood. And then the priest would take both of their hands and they would put it together like this. And they would wrap it around with a white cloth. And they would hold it up, and it says, now make an oath to God, I will never leave you nor forsake you. This is my oath. This is my covenant. This covenant sealed with blood. And Leviticus 17:11 says the life of a person is in the blood. So the putting of it together says that my blood is now your blood. And your blood is my blood. And our blood is together, and our blood is one blood. And it sounds kind of gross, I know. But it was serious stuff. And then when they would untie that, they would put some ointment in there. And ointments would be to prevent infections and stuff. But what it would do is it would leave a scar in each of their hands as a reminder of the covenant that they made. And by the way, the ring today replaces that. That's where the ring whole thing came from, is that reminder thing. And so they'd be joined together that way, their DNA and my DNA fused together. And then they would leave, and they would go to the honeymoon. And the virgin man and the virgin woman, they would get together, and the woman's hymen would be broken, and there would be blood and mingling of fluids and blood, and it sounds kind of graphic, but you get the point. The covenant was sealed not only physically, but the covenant was also sealed emotionally. That said, that my life and your life is now completely joined together, and we have done this. And every time the two people would get together sexually, what it would mean was a resealing of this covenant that they made with each other. Two unilateral covenants, not one bilateral covenant. Two covenants says, I will love you, period. I will love you, period. Not I will love you if you will love me. Really important distinction here to understand what really is meant by the covenant. And while it was physical and emotional, it goes super, super deep. There's something that's called a soul tie. A soul tie says that when you and a person join together in a manner like this, that you're forming a covenant sealed together with blood, sealed together with fluids, sealed together, emotionally you are tied to that person for the rest of your life. Physically you're tied, emotionally you're tied to that person for the rest of your life. And so sometimes what happens, like 15 years later, 20 years later, you're sitting down in your quiet room and your mind starts to go back. I wonder what's happening to Susie Richards. I don't know Susie Richards, by the way. I just picked the name. It's like, Donna's like, who's Susie Richards? Let me ask him about that when I get home. Her name is not Susie, by the way. Her name is not Susan. And so sometimes the call of it comes back, and one of the bad things about social media is that the call is easy to answer with social media. Let me go search. Oh, she used to call herself SQ. So let me go search for SQ, and you find her, and you say, yeah, you get the picture. That's a soul tie. But it's real. And soul ties can be broken, right, through the power of the Holy Spirit. But soul ties naturally occur. It's just a natural occurrence, because of the way God designed us together. But the thing is that it's not only physical, it's not only emotional, but literally what happens that when you come joined together, every single thing gets joined together. Your debts get joined together, right? Your struggles get joined together. Your families get joined together. Your bills get joined together. Your problems get joined together. All of a sudden, their problems become your problems. And the struggles and everything would be shared. And the idea is that you'd become equal partners in life and everything, because you have sealed my life into your life permanently, into this covenant, this two unilateral covenants. And folks, I want to tell you that marriage is not a contract. If you want your marriage to be happy and healthy and full of life, You can't see your marriage as a contract. Well, I'll do this if you do this, and I'll do this if you do this, and I'm not going to do that because you don't do that. You got to see it as, I'm just going to do this. Now, you can be miserable doing it, right, because the other person is not doing fulfilling their contract, but your contract is your contract. And in order for your marriage to be all that, it's got to be, you got to practice the principle of partnership in every area of your married life, in your bodies, in your money, in your family, in your future plans, in your church. I don't believe in married folks going to two different churches. I'm sorry, you guys are married. You guys should be joined together and be doing church together. Your careers. Donna's career is my career. My career is Donna's career. My job is to help her to excel in her career. And her job is to help me to excel. I'm not like, you do your thing, babe, and I go do my thing. That's a contract. That's not a covenant. Words like me and mine, and as the illustrious singer De La Soul would say, me, myself, and I. It's just me, myself, and I. They don't exist. It is we and ours. For your marriage to be happy, you just got to see it that way. And you know, it's not my body, but it's our body. Men love that, right? Men love it's our body. Take my body, babe. It's not my money, but it's our money. It's not my family. It's not your mother. It's our mother. It's not my mother-in-law. It is our mother. Right? By the way, you know, when it's good, you say, my mother-in-law. When it's bad, you say, it's your mother. Yeah, y'all know that, right? You know. When the kids are good, look at my boy. Look at my kids. When they're bad, come get your boy. Come get our boy. We don't talk to our boy. Together. And those words come together. And you know, one of the things that I purpose in my life, I'm pretty transparent to you. I'll share the good and the bad. But I can tell you some things I've learned along the way. And this is one of the things that I purpose in my life from the beginning of our marriage. In 26 years we're at this, is that we wouldn't have jobs in our house. It's your job to do that. It's my job to do that. And the dishes could pile up. I ain't washing the dishes because that ain't my job to wash the dishes. And like, my wife nasty. She ain't washing no dishes. But me, I'm clean. I wash my cup. Look at my cup over there. Spotless. I even use Scotch-Brite. I purpose that in my home. Anything that needs doing, I do. And Donna's purpose that anything that needs doing, she does. Now, there are times when we don't feel like doing stuff. We have norms. You know, there are norms, right? When we first got married, I did the bills. Now she does the bills. So we have norms that, you know, people do stuff. But if the bills aren't being paid, I'm not going to like, you going to let them take the house from us? Where are you going to live? Because I got my money. Better make sure you even go to your parents. Make them to clean out the bedroom. Get rid of the sewing equipment. So I'm going to get a nice place. It's part of a covenant I made to Donna in front of God. Unilateral. The other thing that we purpose to do is we purpose to serve in ministry. I'm not a good musician, not a good singer, but they are. So I learned to play the guitar. And I make sure all the boys learn how to play an instrument so we could serve together. We could do things together. And it's really just kind of one of the things that was deliberate from the start, to serve together in ministry. And as partners, you know, you got to support each other's interests. Like if I like football and she doesn't like football, she'll come and watch a football game with me, and she'll chill out and watch the game. She maybe has her boat there, and she goes, why are those grown men hitting each other like that? That's kind of stupid. And then, but she tries to learn and understand the game so she can participate. And I remember when we first got married, she didn't like football, but she started watching, and I would fall asleep, and she would finish watching the game, and then she would tell me what happened in the game. That's love. No, oh, that's crazy. Because if she liked baseball, I can tell you for sure that wouldn't happen. The moment she'd fall asleep, I'd turn off because I don't like baseball. Where's Greg? Yeah, there he is over there, you know. Baseball's like crickets. Yeah. You know, when you watch it, cue the crickets because everybody falls asleep. All right. So somebody got the joke back there. We do, in a partnership, you do date nights. A partnership, you do vacations together. Now, if the girls want to go away for a girls trip, you know, once, you know, not once a month, but, you know, like, so, you know, once a year or once, you know, they go away for a week, and that's fine. I would say it's dangerous, though, for guys to go away for a guys trip. Let me just tell you, because a bunch of guys get together, they start thinking all kind of crazy stuff, and I'm like, good. And the guys, man, you look good, man, you look good. You go into a restaurant and the girl, you know, she's just nice to you, like, man, she wants me. Yeah, you guys laughing because you know it's true. Last night, I went out with my boys and you know, Donna and stuff. We're in Palm Beach hanging out, and I was in this ice cream shop, this gelato shop, and the girl was like 29 or 30 or whatever like that. But if I was with a bunch of guys, actually, I wasn't even with a bunch of guys. I thought, man, she likes me. She just does. She gave me more ice cream than anybody else. Let me tell you, if that ain't a crush, I don't know what's a crush. So you guys, you know, be wise, right? Because your life is fused. You are joined together in a covenant relationship. And the devil would like nothing better than to destroy that. And he looked for these inroads. And you know, I'm not, you know, guys, I need for you to understand my heart. That's not saying you can't have any interests. You're supposed to have interests because you're still individuals and the other person supports you. But don't lock them out of the things that you're doing. Include them in the stuff. And you get interested in the stuff that your husband or your wife is doing. Do things together. Have fun together. Even when you don't like it. Go to that, I was going to say that, but I was going to say stupid in front of it, and I was like, that's probably not wise. Go to the opera and hear people go, ooh, whatever they do at the opera. I don't know, why do they sing like, anyway, just like things that I think about when I lay down in my bed at night. Practice mutual submission. Just practice mutual submission. Say, you know what, I don't want to go out, but because you do, I do. And don't say, I'm not going to, because you do, I'm going to do it. Just say, I'm going to go out. Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. That's what you do. And requires mutual submission. It requires coming out of your comfort zone. It requires something that I call, I'm going to touch on this a little bit longer, I mean later on, reckless love. Reckless love. Like, man, I don't really care. I may look like a fool, but I'm just going to do it. That's reckless love. And the reason why people don't do it is really a couple of reasons. I'll tell you that the problem is that oftentimes there's a lack of trust. They don't trust that, one partner don't trust that if I trust them with joining the accounts together, or I trust them with my, whatever, if I trust them, they're going to abuse it. And one, because I trusted them before and they made a mess of our finances, I ain't trusting them again. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. And like, I'm not going to trust them. Or a second reason is that I don't want to trust them with being a joint account because he's not going to approve of how I want to spend my money. My money. And the third reason sometimes is because I don't trust that you're really going to stay with me till death do us part. And so I got to, like, you know, have a little protection on the side there. I got to hold back a little bit in my emotions. I got to have a little nest egg on the side just in case you decide to leave. You know, and I personally don't believe in in separate accounts. I believe every account should be joint, every account, even if there's money that there's you kind of manage on the side. I also believe, and I just tell you this, I practice in my household, every password in my household is known by everybody. Because I'm like, I should have no secrets. Now, they don't go in, I don't go in and check their stuff, but I know they could. That's what it is, because we're one. We are one. Her password is my password. My password is her password. We respect the person's individuality, but we are one. And so oftentimes the lack of trust, but sometimes another reason is that there is abuse. An abuse that happened, and oftentimes that comes from experiences that they had before the marriage that they bring into the marriage. And here's a verse that guys love. You know, as I mentioned before, you know, the husband should fulfill his wife's sexual needs. I'm like, okay, baby, somebody, I just got to do it. That's, you know, it's my duty. And the wife should fill her husband's needs, and the wife gives authority over her body to her husband, and the husband gives authority over his body to his wife. And a lot of people, a lot of women, especially men too, in some cases, struggle with that because of experiences where people abused them in some way, shape, or form prior to coming into the marriage, and the marriage suffers from that. So sometimes it's like not the guy's fault at all. And I was looking at some statistics this week, and the statistics are incredible. 20%, one in every five women, if you just look around, you know, the woman in here, one in every five women were abused in some way by a person in authority when they were young. One in five. For boys, it's one in 20. So 5% of boys. And then for girls, this number, one in three girls, or 30% of girls, have been a victim in their later years when they got older of non-consensual sex, of date rape. One in three. And so no wonder like some of that stuff comes into the marriage. And guys, let me tell you, part of our covenant and deal with this is that we got to address it and we got to deal with it. And it requires, we're going to talk about this in 2 weeks' time. It requires transparency. We got to talk. We got to have that know that I can trust the person to tell the person to deal with. But not only that, it requires sensitivity because we got to know and say, hey, this is really a bad thing. It's like, and to help them through it. And if it takes a year or 2 years in counseling, we got to do that. And it involves trust. It involves trust that I know I can trust you with telling you the things that have hurt me. And men, I want to tell you this, that we set the tone of relationships. You don't necessarily want to believe that, but the fact of the matter is, and I've never yet met a woman who had an issue with honoring their husband when their husband treated them right. And actually, that's not true, because there are a couple of exceptions. But usually that comes from stuff that happened before, and they're like deprogramming stuff. But generally speaking, and the reason why I say men set the tone of every relationship with any girl is because of just the way that God designed woman. Y'all can argue with me all you want, and I can tell you the reason why I say that afterwards is that women are, number one, they're responders. A woman is a responder. You treat her well, and she's going to treat you well. That's just kind of the way it works. But not only are they responders, they're multipliers. All right, let me break this down for you. You give them a house, they give you a home. You give them a little loving, they give you kids. You give them grief, they give you hell. I can't say that word in church. Yeah, I can, hell. They multiply whatever you give them. They respond and they amp it up. And we set the tone. If we want our marriages to be great, we got to be the one who are the initiators. And they will respond. And I expect to get some arguments about that afterwards. You know, the fact is that each one of us need to take, regardless of whether man or woman, unilateral, because covenants are unilateral, Covenants require action. Each one of us has got to take unilateral action in order to make our marriage what it's supposed to be, to make us happy and healthy and happy to come home to. Each one of us got to do that, because that's what a covenant, marriage covenant requires. I will do this, period. Now I will do this if you do this. Rather, I'll do it because I've made a covenant to you. So in the series, we've said, it's a series called I Promise. So here's a promise for today. The promise for today is, I promise to actively seek to love my wife or husband with a reckless love. A reckless love says, I don't really care what's going on around me. I'm going to do my thing in loving her or in loving him. We sang a song earlier. I want to point out what reckless love is, because Jesus demonstrated that reckless love. And as Greg was singing this song yesterday when they were practicing, I went and I picked up the words and I started looking at it. And I thought I put the words on. But anyway, let me just read the words to you. It says, before I spoke a word, before I did anything, you were singing over me. You've been so, so good to me. Before I took a breath, you breathe your life into me. You've been so kind to me. Think about that for a second. Didn't require anything on our part, and he was good. And he was kind, but not just good, but so, so good. Not just kind, but so, so kind. Oh, because this is what your partner will say. The overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love. It chases me down. When I'm like, I'm not feeling it, it's chasing me down and running after me till I'm found and leaves the 99. And 99 are all the other good things. It chases me down. I couldn't earn it. I certainly don't deserve it. But you gave yourself away. That's what the other person is saying, right? Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless of God. When I was your foe, when we fought, we're arguing. Still, your love fought for me. Coming after me. You've been so, so good to me. When I felt no worth, when my self-esteem was down in the dirt, and I felt like nothing, like, babe, I got you. You paid it all for me. You've been so, so kind to me. Oh, the overwhelming, never-ending, reckless love of God. That's what he's called for us to have for each other. As I close, I just want to talk 2 seconds to the singles. See, in our Western culture, we have an advantage. We get to do trial runs, and not trial runs all the way, right? But trial runs in our relationships. Let me tell you, if you are dating somebody and they're not demonstrating early signs of practicing the principles of partnership, run for the hills. If every single time you go out and use a dude, take her out, and she don't care whether you're in college and broke, and she's ordering lobster, and every time she wants, where are we going next? What's she going to buy me next? Run for the hills. There's no partnership. I tell you that when I remember my first date with Donna, I'd actually gone out with a girl the previous week, and she ordered lobster. I went out with Donna. Donna ordered something from the appetizer menu. I'm like, this is the one. True story. She can corroborate that. I tell her that all the time. I'm like, she ain't trying to eat me out of house and home, literally. There's got to be, when you're looking, bilateral things going on. Because once you make the covenant, it ain't about the other person. It's just strictly about you to that other person. So you choose wisely. Look to see whether they're practicing the principles of partnership. And the final thing that I want to leave you with is God set out and he demonstrated a reckless love for you and for me. And he says, I'm making a covenant with you. And he says here, I'm going to seal it, not with the blood of animals, but I'm going to seal it with my blood, his blood, poured out for us, which he did on Calvary. And he says, here is my covenant for you. I will save you. I will leave you. I will never forsake you. This covenant is standard and it's true and it's always there. But part of this covenant is that God says, I'm right here. And he says, you have to accept this covenant. If you choose not to accept it, you don't get, his covenant is still there, but you don't get the benefits of the covenant. And so I want to implore you this morning that if you don't know Jesus in a very real way, if you don't know Jesus and haven't experienced firsthand what this reckless love of God means, you need to experience that. If you don't know what this reckless love is, you got to experience it not only for yourself, which is first and foremost in this, because this is vertical, but you won't really, my belief, be able to give that reckless love back in your covenant to your partner. If you want all your marriages to be what it all can be, seek first your one. I'm going to ask that you just rise with us. And I'll be up front. And if you want to talk to me about anything going on in your particular life, or you want to talk to me about your spiritual and you want to accept that reckless condition, the reckless love, I want to offer that to you by praying with you. God bless you.